Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Just about every environmental website, from stopglobalwarming.org to the Sierra Club, offers tips to reduce your carbon footprint and save the planet. Stop Global Warming recommends using compact fluorescent bulbs, inflating your tires, ditching plastic water bottles, taking shorter showers, buying products locally, eating less meat, bringing cloth bags to the market. The list goes on. Treehugger suggests riding a bicycle, using eco-friendly household cleaners and low-flow toilets. Just about every site and group in the country offers similar suggestions. And maybe you've incorporated a few or all of these practices into your daily life because you truly care about minimizing your carbon footprint. But in the larger scheme of things, how much of a difference are these things really making? Today's guest, environmental activist Derek Jensen, says forget shorter showers. Personal change does not equal political or social change. In the latest issue of Orion magazine, he writes, would any sane person think dumpster diving would have stopped Hitler, or that composting would have ended slavery or brought about the 8-hour workday, or that dancing naked around a fire would have helped put in place the Voting Rights Act of 1957 or the Civil Rights Act of 1964? Then why now, with all the world at stake, do so many people retreat into these entirely personal solutions? Derek Jensen goes on to say that the role of an activist is not to navigate systems of oppressive power with as much integrity as possible, but rather to confront and take down those systems. Derek Jensen is the author of several books. His latest two are Songs of the Dead and What We Leave Behind. And Derek Jensen joins us from Crescent City. Hi, Derek. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you. So your latest article, Forget Shorter Showers, was sent around all over Facebook. I saw it on a number of environmental and news websites. And in fact, the article that originally appeared in Orion magazine got over 250 comments. So why don't you lay out your overall argument for us?
Well, I think you already did in the intro. But the argument is that, we hear all the time, for example, that the world's running out of water, and that, you know, that's obviously a big deal there in the Bay Area and in California with running out of water. And so, therefore, people should take shorter showers. And that's one of the arguments. And, well, actually, 90% of the water used by human beings is used for agriculture and industry. And the same amount of water is used by municipal humans as used for municipal golf courses. So, yes, people are dying from a lack of water all over the world, but it's not because the world's running out of water. It's because the water's being stolen. And another way to put this is that, you know, the Colorado River doesn't reach the ocean anymore. And if all the dams on the Colorado were to fail and the water were once again to reach the ocean, you know, I can just hear the capitalist press braying as one that the people in Arizona are going to die of thirst. And yes, there are more people in Arizona than the water system can handle, or than the water can handle. But that doesn't alter the fact that I wouldn't want to hear one word of complaint as long as there still exists a single golf course, a single lawn, a single swimming pool, a single irrigated alfalfa field, a single irrigated citrus orchard, as long as Las Vegas still existed. And we can talk about this with all sorts of, you know, it doesn't matter whether we're talking energy consumption or waste production. The average person in the United States, the per capita waste production, municipal waste production, is about 1,600 pounds. So in the average year, you and the government offices associated with you, basically municipal waste is everything that's put out at the curb. And that's about 1,600 pounds. So let's say you're this sort of hardcore, simple living activist who's going to reduce your waste down to zero, which actually, frankly, I reduce my waste as much as I can. So you reduce it all the way down to zero. Well, I got bad news, which is that when you include industry, the average U.S. per capita waste production is about, I can't do the math right now, but it's your individual waste is about 3% of the total. So it's 97% is of your share of the waste is actually produced by industry and agriculture. And then it's the same for global warming. You know, we watch An Inconvenient Truth, which does, I think, a really good job of introducing the problem of global warming. And this happens all the time. It happened with the movie that just came out, Food, Inc., which does a great job of laying out the problem. And then at the end, every time they retreat into these personal solutions with An Inconvenient Truth, all the suggestions at the end have to do with inflating your tires. They have to do with changing your compact fluorescence. And even if every single person in the United States did that, that's if every person, which isn't going to happen, if every person did that, that would reduce carbon one time by 21%. And what was noticeably absent from An Inconvenient Truth was any mention, any real mention of corporate power.
Mm.
And also what was absent was any notion of the growth economy on which capitalism requires growth. And so even if every person in the United States did this and reduced their consumption or reduced their CO2 production by 21%, then if you have an economy growing at, let's say, 2% per year, I mean, that whole thing's gone in a few years.
You bring up a number of points, and when you said that capitalism requires growth, the first thing that came to my mind was these clunker rebates. Already $1 billion is being used for people to buy new cars, and the Senate is going to pass another $2 to $3 billion. But I just wanted to, and we'll talk about that later in the show. Now, in your piece, you say that you're not saying that people should not live simply, because you live simply. You don't drive much, you don't have kids. But you are saying that we can't pretend that not buying much or buying fair trade, which some people kind of replace buying with buying good things, quote unquote, it's not a powerful political act. It's not revolutionary. You say that personal change does not equal social and political change.
Yeah, and part of the problem with all this is we've been handed this major con job, and the con job is a bunch of them, obviously. But, you know, the fact that we believe we live in a democracy, there's a nice one right there. But back to your point, the 1980s were the first time that the corporate media first called human beings consumers more often than it called them citizens. And if you can accept that redefinition of yourself from a citizen to a consumer, then your range of resistance will be much narrower. So that if I perceive myself as a consumer and all those places are saying, you know, buy this, buy that, don't buy this, don't buy that, basically as a consumer, your choices are consume and don't consume, buy and don't buy. And as a citizen, you have a much wider range of resistance, which could include voting, not voting, pamphleting, organizing, boycotting. And when a government becomes destructive of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, you have the right to alter or abolish it. And then there's an even more wrenching transformation that came about several thousand years ago, which is the conversion. They got us to accept the idea that we were citizens of a state as opposed to human animals in community who need habitat and who will, if our communities are threatened, we have teeth and claws. And so a lot of my American Indian friends say to me that the first and most important thing that we have to do is to decolonize our hearts and minds.
Mm.
That is to recognize that technological progress does not serve the world, and to recognize that we're living on stolen land, and to recognize that this way of life is killing the planet. It's like a doctor friend of mine always says. He's great. He's a combination. It's John Osborne. He used to be the heart and soul of the Spokane, Washington environmental community, which is where I started as an activist. And he's also a doctor. He's a VA guy by day, a VA doctor by day, and then he puts on his, you know, captain and ecologist cape at night and does that. And what he would always say is the first step toward cure is proper diagnosis. And so one of the things that I'm talking about in this is looking at the, okay, I'm going to jump a different direction here for a second. And that is that Robert J. Lifton wrote this great book called The Nazi Doctors. And in this book, he asked, how is it that men who had taken the Hippocratic Oath could go work in Nazi death camps as doctors? And what he found is that actually many of them, not all of them, because there was Mengele who was just horrible, but many of them actually cared very deeply for the health of the inmates, and they would do what they could to help them. They would, if they were sick, they would give them an aspirin to lick, or they would hide them from the selection officers who were going to kill them, or they would put them to bed for a day or two. They'd give them an extra scrap of potato. And they did everything they could except for the most important thing of all, which is they didn't question the existence of the death camp itself. And that's what I see activists, including myself, doing all the time, which is we are doing everything we can, every little bit we can do to try to protect some this or that piece of ground or this or that creature whom we love. And we're doing everything we can except for the most important thing of all, which is to question the existence of this entire culture that is turning the entire world into first a work camp and then a death camp. And so one of the things I want for us to do is to question this larger culture. See, that's one of the things, too, is that what do all of the so-called solutions to global warming have in common? What they all have in common is they all take industrial capitalism as a given, and they take the natural world as that which must conform to industrial capitalism. But that's insane in terms of being out of touch with physical reality, because the world has to come first. The world must come first. That's what is basis. That's the basis for all life. Without a world, you don't have industrial capitalism. You don't have anything. And so the question we need to be asking, and the implicit question, and oftentimes explicit question, in all of these debates about environmental problems are, gosh, you know, how can we keep this way of life going? I mean, you got Lester Brown with his plan B to save civilization. Or you got somebody as smart as Peter Montague, who up until recently ran the indispensable Rachel's newsletter on toxics. And in one of his articles, he was talking about how it was really carbon sequestration is a really bad idea, you know, pumping it way underground. That's a really bad idea because if you put a bunch down there, it all escapes at once. It could, quote, disrupt civilization as we know it. Well, actually, no, Peter. What could happen is it could kill the planet. And, you know, 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone. You know, 99% of the wetlands, 98% of 99% of prairies, 98% of native forests. And what we need to do is to recognize that the world is more important than this economic system. And everything we do in the meantime is going to be tinkering around the edges. And I did one last thing, and then I'll stop here. But I did this terrible, terrible radio interview with this guy in Santa Barbara maybe a couple of years ago. He was a right-wing anti-environmentalist, property rights over all his Bible thumper. And he evidently wanted environmentalists to yell at. I didn't know this going into the interview. And I was saying, you know, 90% of large fish in the oceans are gone, that there's 10 times as much plastic as phytoplankton in the ocean. That's the equivalent of styrofoam 90 feet thick through all the forest. That's the equivalent of every 10 bites you take, 9 of them are plastic. And there's dioxin in every mother's breast milk. There's flame retardant in every mother's breast milk, human, non-human, doesn't matter, all over the world. I was talking about all this, and he kept saying the same thing to me, which is, Derek, that's all fine. Let's get back in the real world. And what I realized is that it's not just him being crazy, but that's what a lot of people consider the real world. They consider this culture more important than the real physical world. And in many ways, it's no wonder, because if I say the name Angelina Jolie to you, do you know who I'm referring to?
Yes, I do.
Same with Jennifer, Brad, you know.
And Derek, we have to take a short break. We're speaking with Derek Jensen. His latest piece is in Orion Magazine. You can find a link at yourcallradio.org. He says, forget shorter showers. Personal change does not equal political or social change. What do you think? Give us a call, 866-798-8255. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW 91.7 FM San Francisco. Coming up at noon, it's Philosophy Talk. Today's discussion is the intersection of philosophy and literature.
Boa sorte, não tenho o que dizer, são só palavras, e o que eu sinto não mudará, tudo que quer me dar é demais, é pesado, não há paz, tudo que quer de mim, irreais, expectativas desleais.
That's it. There's no way, it's over.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our daily newsletter to find out what's coming up. Tomorrow, Sandeep Roy will have a conversation about the House's health care reform bill. Would you vote for it? What's in it? What's left out? Do you think it goes far enough? That's tomorrow. Thursday, we'll have a conversation about schools. And Friday, it's our media roundtable. If there's a reporter suggestion you have, send us an email. I'm actually hoping to find a reporter from the Congo. So if you know of anyone, we'd love to hear from you. The email is feedback@yourcallradio.org. But today we are talking with environmental activist Derek Jensen. He's got a piece in the latest issue of Orion magazine, and it's called Forget Shorter Showers. He says personal change does not equal social change. The role of an activist is not to navigate systems of oppressive power with as much integrity as possible, but rather to confront and take down those systems. So the question is how? We're going to actually talk about solutions on the show today. Derek, I've heard you interviewed on a number of shows, and the debate for a half hour as well, but what if I eat less meat? It does make a big difference. What if I drive a car that gets higher gas mileage? It does make a difference. And a lot of these interviews fail to really talk about what you would actually do. So as Derek argues about oppressive power and really changing the system as we know it, what would be at the top of your list? And what do you think of his overall argument? 866-798-8255. And if you're involved with an environmental group that does have this list on the website about taking shorter showers, buying locally, buying minimally packaged goods, eating less meat, what do you think about Derek's argument that in the larger scheme of things, it really doesn't make a difference? You can also give us a call at email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. So we've got a number of callers on the line. But before we get to them, Derek, I did want to ask you, you've written a number of books on this topic. And 2 years ago, you wrote an article called Beyond Hope, saying that we're losing badly on every front. I don't have much hope, but that's a good thing. Hope is what keeps us chained to the system. So what is at the very top of your list? What change would you like to see?
Well, it's pretty clear that the industrial infrastructure is killing a planet, and the industrial infrastructure needs to go, and every cell in my body wants for us to have a voluntary transformation where, you know, we start by, you know, taking shorter showers today, and tomorrow we all storm the golf courses and rip them up, and the day after that we, you know, get rid of jet skis, and the day after that, you know, every day we're moving in the right direction. There are 2 million dams in the United States. There are 60,000 dams over 13 feet tall and 70,000 dams over 6.5 feet tall. Looks like I got those last two reversed. There are 70,000 dams over 6.5 feet tall. And if we only took out one of those dams every day, it would take 200 years to take all those 70,000 dams out. And the salmon don't have that time, and the sturgeon don't have that time. What I would like to see is for us to be moving in the right direction. And I don't frankly care how that happens, whether we're moving in the right direction through because we all of a sudden stop being insane and caring more about Angelina Jolie than we do about the land where we live, or if it happens because fewer of us decide to protect the world at all costs. And so once again, every cell in my body wants for this to happen voluntarily. I just see everything moving in the wrong direction. And what we need to do is to dismantle this entire wretched system that's been killing the planet for the last several thousand years. And that's incredibly scary. And that's one of the reasons we don't do it, apart from the fact that we in the United States, especially the global elite, those in the industrialized nations, benefit greatly from all of this destruction. There's a great line by this pro-slavery philosopher in the 1830s talking about how you can't get rid of slavery because how would we get the comforts or elegancies upon which our life is based? And, you know, we're selling out the world pretty cheaply for, you know, the phone that I'm holding here and the phone you're holding, and or I guess you're in a studio, you know. And that's another part of it is that you know, the machines have already won. We're already surrounded. There's you know, those crazy science fiction people say we're going to be put into machines. We're already inside machines. Look around right now. How many machines do you see within 20 feet of you? And how many wild animals do you see within 20 feet of you? And how many wild animals do you have a daily relationship with versus how many machines do have a daily relationship, but we're already inside the machine. And what I would like to see happen, but there's a step first, and it's the decolonization. What I would like to see happen is for people to wake up from this nightmare of this culture and to begin to recognize that we are living on stolen land, and to say, whose land is this? When I was making the point about Angelina Jolie, it's like, we know who Angelina Jolie is, but whose land are you on right now? What indigenous people was that land stolen from? And a lot of times I'll ask the question, and nobody knows. Mm-hmm. And so the first thing is to simply get the proper diagnosis, and then that will lead us toward cure.
If you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. And let's go to our first caller, Kevin in San Francisco.
Yeah, hi.
Hi, Kevin.
Thanks for having the discussion. I've read all Derek's books. He's a great writer, and he's proved it once again in this piece. It's just,
this is Kevin Danaher with Global Exchange.
Right, right.
Hi, Kevin.
Hi, thanks. And I think there's a writer's device of like, shorter showers aren't going to. I think the point is there's not a necessary contradiction between cleaning up your personal life and being a conscious consumer and a conscious user of resources and being a radical revolutionary that wants to overthrow capitalism and imperialism. We try to integrate those in our work at Global Exchange, where we do the green festivals, which is fun and music, and you see all these green products. But we also tell people you can't buy your way into the revolution. You're not going to just go out and buy a Prius and then, okay, you're guilt free. But I think on the other hand, guilt and shame are condiments. It's like pepper, just a little bit. You don't want too much. Because I know some leftists that are paralyzed. They're just like, oh, we're doomed. And that's where killing the planet, I'd quibble with the wording, we're killing the planet's ability to support human life. The planet is going to do fine without us. The cockroaches and rats will do great. The weeds in my yard will do fine. So it's about us confronting our own species genocide. And we're starting to wake up, and you see signs of it every place. You know, those of us that are out there doing this at the street level, in the high schools, in the community colleges, in city governments, in corporate leadership, they have sustainability officers. And, yeah, there's greenwashing, but there's also really genuine change-oriented people who are burrowing inside those institutions, trying to move them in a different direction. So I think people should take the attitude of an activist toward this and, yes, clean up your personal act, but as Derek says, don't think that that substitutes for political revolution and structural change.
Thanks for calling in, Kevin. Stay on the line. Derek, what are your thoughts?
Well, a couple of things. Well, three things. First is, thank you for your work, which I think is very important. The second is, there's one part I agree with, one part I disagree with. The part I agree with, totally, is I don't actually choose the title, as you know from writing articles. The title was, I would not have chosen the title Forget Shorter Showers, because I don't see it as a revolution. I don't believe in the revolution versus reform dichotomy. You know, if we all wait for the great glorious revolution, then there's not going to be anything left anyway. And if all we do is this reform work, then there's not going to be anything left. It's going to grind away until there's nothing left. And we need it all. And sometimes I'm pegged as a violence guy, and that's not really accurate. I'm the everything guy. And I think about this in terms of like rape crisis centers, that no woman I know who works on a rape crisis hotline believes that that's going to stop rape, but that doesn't alter the fact that it's important work. And so I totally agree that we need it all. Sure, clean up your own life and, you know, take a shorter shower, whatever, but at the same time recognize that, you know, water is being used, that we need the institutional change. And the part I disagree with is where you were saying that the world will do fine. I would have to say that the Delta smelt respectfully disagree, and the salmon respectfully disagree, and great apes disagree, and migratory songbirds disagree, and the oceans actually disagree. 90% of the sharks are gone. And we can talk about the world will be fine, but every one of those are communities and individuals whose lives are just as precious to them as ours are to us. And also, sometimes when people say, well, everything will be fine, what I do is I ask if anybody in the room has a knife. And then I take the knife and I walk up to the person. I say, can you give me your hand, please? And I was like, why? I said, well, I'm not going to kill you. I'm just going to cut off your finger. And I'm going to cut off another finger. And then I'm going to start skinning your leg. And this is not just about human survival. This is about black terns, and it's about white rhinos, and it's about all these others, all these other wonderful beings with whom we share this planet for now, who are being killed in this moment, and that is an outrage. And I know you agree with the fact that it's an outrage, otherwise you wouldn't be doing the work. But it's not just about humans, and that's one of the things that we have to move away from, is the notion that we are the stars of this play, and everybody else is basically just furniture or, at best, supporting characters. The salmon are... Somebody wrote me the other day and said, you know, is it okay to kill a few bats to make wind energy? And I wrote back and said, well, first off... And, well, no, and they said, is it okay to kill a few bats to save some humans? I wrote back and said, well, actually, no. It's not killing a few bats to save humans. It's killing a few bats to provide electricity, which is a different thing, and killing a lot of bats. But second, why are humans more important than bats? I think part of our fundamental problem is human exceptionalism, and then what people call anthropocentrism, but lately I've started calling human supremacism. Anyway, I know that I've drifted from where you were in the first place.
Kevin, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, and I'm not accusing you of human supremacism. I'm just saying that I disagree with that part, that the world will be fine. The world may or may not eventually recover, depending on what happens with global warming. But right now, you know, there are the fact that, you know, right now, salmon, the salmon in Alaska are collapsing right now, and that's not okay.
So Kevin, give us your thoughts just on, you know, can you point to some victories over the past few years? Because I wanted to also ask Derek what he thinks of Van Jones' work. I know that you work with Van.
Yeah.
He's now in D.C. working on his Green Job Initiative.
Well, first, I totally agree with what Derek just said. This whole thing of, oh, you know, we're the dominant species. We can do whatever the hell we want. That's obviously got to change. And I think, you know, we could go back and forth, glass half empty, glass half full. The glass half full side is that we're in the early stages of a massive transition to a whole new way of relating to the planet. For 500-600 years, money values have dominated the life cycle. And now we're starting to move into a period where life values will dominate the money cycle. We're, the average species on this planet lasts about 1 million years. We're about 150 to 200,000 years old. So we're exiting adolescence and entering adulthood. And we're starting to realize as a species that we can't keep going. It was the salmon fishermen in Northern California for the second year in a row who came out and canceled the fishing because they realized their livelihoods are at stake if they keep fishing. So they have to stop and let the salmon regrow. So there is a recognition happening, and I think our job as activists is to find as many different tactical ways to get people into this movement. And it might be at a demonstration. It might be writing letters to Congress. It might be a speech. It might be reading Derek's article. It might be reading one of my books. But there's many, many different doors, and we have to be sensitive to not getting into what I call tactical sectarianism, you know, where the people who do demonstrations, we're really radical, and the people who write letters to Congress, oh, no, this is how you change legislation. This is more important. Those are all tactical fronts that need to be united under some strategic vision of how do we make this transition from having commerce dominating life to instead having life dominate commerce. That's the transition we have to make.
And you really see a transition happening right now, Kevin?
Yeah, but it's happening at the grassroots, and it's not covered by the corporate media. But don't forget, the corporate media are all dying. The newspapers, magazines, TV, etc., they're all going bust because they can't get the advertising revenue because more people now are getting their information from the Internet, not going. You got Twitter. People should check out Carrot Mob. Look at Carrot Mob. It's just a brilliant concept, and it's getting out there around the world. So there's all sorts of activism at the grassroots level. Our last book, Building the Green Economy, was all about success stories at the grassroots. They don't get covered. They don't get publicized. Most people don't know about them, but that doesn't mean they're not real and they're not affecting things. There's over 850 cities that signed on to the Kyoto Protocols. The federal government didn't, but almost 900 cities did it through grassroots activism. So that's where we're plugged in, and that's where I get my hope from. It's not some ideology. It's from practical activity that's changing things.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Kevin. That's Kevin Danaher with Global Exchange. Kevin talks about success stories, Derek, and we got an email from Denise who says, yes, there has to be systemic change, but we all know that it takes one person to make changes. Rachel Carson comes to mind. In the early 70s, I myself, that's Denise, am noted for starting one of the largest departments in the city on the road to recycling phone books, cardboard, and paper, along with reducing use of material at a savings of millions of dollars. So what are your thoughts about success stories like this?
Well, what's most important to me is what's happening in the real world. And I love Rachel Carson, and I think she's wonderful, and she did wonderful work. And that doesn't alter the fact that in the last 40 years, which is post-Rachel Carson, whippoorwill populations have gone down by 80%, bobwhite populations down by about 70%. And yes, I do see some people doing better work, and I see increasing recognition of the, I mean, people are talking about global warming when it wasn't talked about so much. Oh, but see, even that's crap, because I had the misfortune to watch Soylent Green maybe a month ago, mm-hmm. and, you know, that awful Charlton Heston movie?
Yes, it's a great movie.
And do you know why they're having to eat everybody, that many humans? Because of global warming. That's like 1972 science fiction cheese. And when I was in college in 1980s, my professor was talking about runaway global warming. One of my physics professors was talking about runaway global warming in the early 1980s. So, yeah, it's talked about a lot more, and Al Gore won the Nobel Prize. But where I always come back to is the real physical world. And the real physical world, Where I live, squirrels actually disappeared a few years ago. For years, I've talked about how, you know, there's this pond right next to my house where I can hear that the frogs are so loud that you can't have a human conversation at night. And for years, I've been writing that when is the amphibian, worldwide amphibian die-off going to come home? And this is the year it came home. And I only heard 5 or 6 frogs every night during the spring, as opposed to it being, you know, deafening.
And you're up in Crescent City, which is about 7 hours north of San Francisco.
That's correct.
Right.
And so in the real physical world, I'm not seeing, I mean, yeah, there are some individual stories that are heartening, and I think that that's really important and for us to attend to. But the real physical world is being dismantled around us. And yes, I'm so glad for increasing recognition of this. I'm so glad for movement at the grassroots, and I'm in no way undercutting that and undercutting the work that people are doing, which I think is absolutely crucial. But when I look at real metrics, when I look at the real measures in the real physical world, I see a lot of stuff going straight to hell. And there's yeah, so that's all. There's probably a lot of callers.
There are a number of callers.
Okay.
And I want to thank Denise for her email. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. And as soon as a line opens up, I'll give you the phone number. Let's go next to John in Berkeley. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. First off, I'd like to make a comment of something that happened right here in the Bay Area a few weeks ago. Up in the Lakeshore area of Oakland, there was a petition being sent around protesting the hike in parking fees by the city of Oakland. These rather wealthy people in that well-to-do neighborhood are concerned about the fact that people won't be coming into the neighborhood to shop because of the parking fees. Now, this is the same neighborhood with the Grand Lake Theater that had a big marquee about Al Gore's movie An Inconvenient Truth. And yet these very same Al Gore supporters want to bring in more CO2 and more pollution and more cars into their neighborhood. Let's face it, it's all about money. And that's the thing that I really don't hear talked about very much is money. The fact that there are powerful moneyed interests behind this whole industrial techno society that we have. And eventually, if you're going to change and save this planet, you're going to have to come up against them. And it's something I really don't hear discussed very much, because even the most left liberal Democrat is going to march lockstep with the Republicans, as we see here, on the issue of money. And as for a solution, I think that what we have to seriously think about is looking outside the Democratic Party. there are a lot of people out there who would call themselves independents, libertarians, and even Republicans that have some very good ideas as to how to deal with this crisis. But because we're trapped within this whole left liberal Democratic Party way of looking at things, we tend to either reject or ignore these other people. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you for the call, John. What about that, Derek? A Public Citizen just came out with a new piece today that looked at the number of interests on the climate bill. More than 460 new business and interest groups jumped into lobbying Congress on global warming in the weeks before the House voted on climate change. It's hard to tell how much money they spent, but Public Citizen says the cost is more than $27 million just between April and June. So what about this question just about money in the pockets of politicians?
Well, people used to complain, or people used to laugh in the 1980s at the Soviet Politburo. In the 1970s, the Soviet Politburo was, what, 97% or 98% Communist Party members? Ho-ho, they don't have a democracy. What a joke. But what percentage of U.S. House of Representatives and Senate are Capitalist Party members? Suddenly we're not laughing quite so hard. I think that I used to teach at a relatively conservative school, Eastern Washington University, and I would ask my students, do you believe we live in a democracy? And they would just laugh. Of course we don't. And I would ask, do you believe that the government that takes better care of corporations or individual human beings? And they would just laugh. And wasn't there something happened a couple hundred years ago about this, I don't know, there were some people who complained a little bit about this thing called, what was it, taxation without representation? I think that led to some rather jarring events, but their big complaint was that. And clearly we're not represented. Everybody knows this. And I totally agree that the Democratic Party is not... I mean, it's a good cop, bad cop, with the Republicans just being bad cops, and the Democrats then come in and they smile while they perform the same function. They serve capital. That's their job. And the whole system... I want to go back to something that Kevin said about, you know, and I totally agree about we all need to work together. And something that's very, very important is that at its strongest, only 2% of IRA members ever picked up weapons. That we do need to have a wide variety of tactics. That even the IRA, once again, at its strongest, only 2% were picking up weapons. 98% were doing all sorts of other support work. And on the Underground Railroad, Harriet Tubman carried a gun, but she worked with quilt makers. She worked with Quakers. You can't get much more pacifist than a Quaker. And we need to recognize this wide variety of tactics, and we need to recognize the problem, and part of the problem, and the problem goes much deeper than this, but part of it is, yeah, the Democrats are not our friends either. And then one last thing on this, which is, it's so funny, you know, I live up in one county north of Humboldt, which can describe for you pretty much the marijuana politics of the region, and about a year ago, the Board of Supervisors was going to reduce the number of marijuana plants that a person could have with a Prop 215 card. Oh, my gosh. The building was packed. You wouldn't believe how many people. I mean, it's like the Board of Supervisors could not have, if they would have decided to go ahead and reduce the number, they couldn't have got out of there alive. You know, the place was packed. This was participatory democracy in action. And the thing that breaks my heart about this is that if we were going to try to do the same thing for something about protecting salmon, there would be 8 people in there, you know, 2 commercial fishermen, and then the same 6 people who show up to protest the invasion of Iraq. And one of mine, I've said this up in B.C. and got a huge roar from a crowd when I said that I wish people loved the salmon as much as they love their marijuana. And my point in bringing up this whole thing is that for one moment, even though it was quote, only, end quote, about medical marijuana, for one moment, there was participatory democracy in Crescent City. And I would love if people loved the land as much as they love that. Is that making sense?
Yeah, and I was actually going to say, we did a show about The Cove. Have you heard about this new documentary about dolphins being slaughtered?
Yeah,
and this is getting, we're talking mainstream press coverage, a lot of attention. So do you think that documentaries like The Cove could result in action.
Well, yes, and I think...
And it's about the slaughter of dolphins. We did this last Wednesday, I believe, yes.
Right. I think, and once again, I think that it can, just like a letter to the editor can, and just like a book can. I think that, here's a great story. I was watching the wonderful movie Battle of Algiers. Have you seen that?
Yes.
Okay, it's one of the best movies about an insurgency ever done. And it's about the Algerian insurgency against the French. And I'm watching this with a friend of mine, and I say, so who would I be in this movie? And I'm just asking for strokes, you know. It's like, oh, you'd be one of the blah, 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 one of the brave ones. And I said, who would I be? And my friend said, oh, you'd be dead. I'm like, thank you very much. And my friend said, no, you'd be dead for 30 years, and your books are on the bookshelves of the people who are fighting against the French. And my point in bringing that up is, once again, that we need it all. We need propagandists. We need people to do above ground work. I mean, that was one of the brilliant things that the IRA and the Sinn Féin did. You know, you need this above ground organization. I would love it if the Green Party turned into the U.S. equivalent of the Sinn Féin, you know, with a firewall between them and the below ground activities. But to have, let's get serious. What we really need, I mean, honestly, right now, do you think that the corporate-controlled Congress is capable of acting against capital? I know I'm really, really not asking a fair question here because I'm guiding you to the answer. The corporate-controlled Congress is capable of acting against capital such that it would significantly slow global warming.
Well, it's pretty clear based on the global warming bill that passed the House. It was completely watered down.
Yeah, but the answer, even on that level, and much less, you know, deindustrializing or stopping international trade, you know, even on that level, what about getting rid of NAFTA? You know, it's like even on those levels, it's not serving us. I want to tell one real quick story here, which is that...
And, Derek, we have a number of callers, and I can't believe the hour has gone by so fast. We only have about 10 minutes left, so I want to get to a few people because they've been waiting patiently, and then I will ask you to share your story. Let's hear from Hill in Walnut Creek. Hi, Hill. Thanks for holding.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to... I basically am in concert with everything the young man said, but I believe the shrinking your carbon footprint is not something you could throw out, and that one of the basic early tenets of the early feminist movement was the personal is political. I believe that with all my soul. I've lived that way. Harriet Tubman lived that way. She saved one slave at a time. Rachel Carson lived that way. It doesn't, you know, and yes, we have to go way beyond that and, you know, hit the corporate bullshit stuff where it lives. I don't mean to, excuse me, you know, it's not that we shouldn't stop the corporate stuff from happening because it's killing the planet. We also forget that I'm a relative last 5 years recent resident of California. We're really lucky here. New York is a trip. New Jersey is a trip. It stinks. There's too many people, and people are really dying out there. Let's remember that a 7-year-old needs to take the baby steps and go, even if it's not the corporate level, they need to be able to say, okay, I'm going to shrink my carbon footprint. What does that mean? And, you know, or a 33-year-old in Brooklyn, okay, shrink my carbon footprint. What does that mean? You know? But thank you very much. It's very enlightening, and thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Hill, and thanks for catching that word. I appreciate that. Let's go next to Bob in Santa Cruz. Hi, Bob. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for taking my call. People want to be told. I think that's the default reality in any political system. We're lucky that we have the checks and balances that we have so that things don't get too far out of hand. I think your guess is coming from I don't know what field he's really coming from. We are the stars at this play, Derek. We're human beings. We have favorable brain-to-body-weight ratio. We have an opposing thumb. And if you look at least the 1/5 of the planet that has a first-degree economy, what people want, what people are appeased by, are not bad. Personal transportation is not bad. Yeah, we have a dramatic effect on the environment, and we are learning, I think, to clean up our act and close off our pollution loops. And these are all good things. But to wantonly cry for the destruction of the system is, to me, a crackpot. We align in self-interest. And to think you're going to stop that is to want to be like North Korea.
And, Bob, when you say that people want to be told, can you elaborate on that?
Most certainly. You look at the two major parties. They are balloon fests, primarily. They're entertainment shows. Barack Obama got elected by sloganeering. I voted for Obama, by the way. But other people are attracted to other forms of intense sloganeering. This is going to happen whether we like it or not. I think people want to be told primarily because they're afraid.
Sorry, Bob. We have a bad connection, so we have to let you go.
I bet you do.
Oh, I think it's fine now. No, we had a bad connection with you, Bob.
Great. But we're afraid of individual accountability, and that's mm-hmm. one of the keys to understanding, in my opinion, the human condition.
All right. You brought up two. Sorry, Bob. Your line's bad. We've got to let you go. You brought up two. There we go. You brought up two points. First off, what about that one, Derek, that, you know, we have an email from someone who said, you know, tell this to a mom who's got two kids and a single mom and is just trying to make ends meet. Maybe she does want to help the planet, but she can't do anything radical. And for her, recycling is a pretty big deal. And then you've got other people who, quite frankly, do need to be led and need to sort of follow their leaders. And if Obama talks about recycling and building a garden, others might follow. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I guess three things. The first one is that the caller who just called in is a great example of what I was talking about with the human supremacist. And people who think that the world was created for humans or that evolved for humans or whatever, there's really not, you can't really talk to them any more than you can talk to a pro-slavery philosopher, you know, who believed that Africans were created for whites. It's the same sense of entitlement. And the fundamental difference between Western and indigenous ways of being is that indigenous peoples the world over have believed that the world consists of other beings to enter into relationship with as opposed to objects to be exploited. And the Tala will live where I live right now. The Tala will live here for 12,500 years without destroying the place. There are models for how to live. And one of the models is, there's a great line by a Canadian lumberman. When I look at trees, I see dollar bills. And if when you look at trees, you see dollar bills, you're going to treat them one way, and as we see. And if when you look at trees, you see trees, then you'll treat them a different way. And once again, the Tala lived here for 12,500 years without destroying the place. And so it's extraordinary to say that the world was created for us. We see this. How do we tell whether that perspective that the world was created for us is true? I'll tell you this. If you can live with the truth for 12,500 years, I believe it's more true. But so far as the woman who has two kids, like I said, only 2% of the IRA ever picked up weapons or did decisive action. We need everything. And the person with the single mother with the two kids, I mean, what she should do, one of the things she should do is raise her children to love the land where they live. And teach them about the land where they live, and to raise healthy children who question everything, and who aren't going to be some of those people who need to be led, but instead think for themselves, and who, if they're men, they ally with women in this patriarchy, and if they're women, they refuse to take on the values of the patriarchy, men and women. And so I think that there's a lot that people can do from where they are.
I want to thank Bob for calling in, and I just want to make sure that, I mean, we don't know Bob's story, so to compare him to a pro-slavery philosopher.
Oh, it's pretty clear, though, because he was saying that basically that humans, it's okay for us to, that we are the stars. And when the Europeans invaded Africa, they said that it was okay to enslave the Africans because, quote, when they speak, they fart with their tongues in their mouth. They didn't speak Portuguese, so they didn't speak. And it's the same, that's really central to what is killing the planet is this sense of entitlement. Sense of entitlement is central to like 90% of atrocity, whether it's domestic violence or whether it's enslaving the planet. So that sense of entitlement is key to attempt to stop.
And Derek, I want to just get in one last caller because we don't have much time. Sure. Ellen, if you can be brief, please, that would be great. Ellen in Oakland.
Yeah. Sure. Hi. Thank you for having me. What I just wanted to speak on was...
And we only have about 20 seconds, Ellen.
Okay. I represent the Mobilization for Climate Justice, and we're running the anti-Chevron rally out in Richmond this Saturday. And what we're really trying to do is illustrate that there is a coalition of groups in the Bay that are working at the root of the problem and facing the system in its face, with corporations like Chevron who are polluting communities around the world. And we're doing it with educated analysis and direct action. So on Saturday, that's what we're going to be doing. It's 11:30 at the Richmond BART station.
All right, thank you. We'll put a link on the website right after the show. Derek Jensen, 20 seconds, final thoughts. I know you've got a new book out, so we'll definitely have you back to continue this conversation.
Well, I guess my final thoughts, I would like to say thank you to that last caller for her work.
All right, well, Derek Jensen, I want to thank you, and we will bring you back because I've got pages of questions that I wasn't able to ask you, and we have a number of people still on the line. Sorry we didn't get to your phone calls, but we will have Derek Jensen back. You can find his latest article in Orion Magazine, Forget Shorter Showers. He says that he did not come up with the headline at our website, yourcallradio.org. Thanks again, Derek.
Thank you so much.
And thanks for your calls and emails. I'll be right back to let you know what's coming up tomorrow. On the next Your Call, we'll discuss the plan the House will vote on when they return from the August recess. What's in the bill? What's left out? Do you think it goes far enough? If not, could you support it as a step in the right direction? Send us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org or join us live at 11 a.m. Are you willing to compromise on health care reform? And what does compromise mean to you? It's Your Call with Sandeep Roy and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW and the friends of KALW. To listen to past shows, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find links there to the Your Call blog and podcast. Malihe Razazan is producer, Ben Temption is senior producer, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor, and Kate Elston is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.